What we're going to be doing, as you will have gathered, is considering a question tonight. Our question is this: security in a world of uncertainty. And William Taylor is going to be answering that question for us. We're very grateful to William, who is somewhere, for being willing to come and speak. William's a rector up at St. Helens Bishopsgate, which is a church just down the road from us here in the city. And he's been working here now for about 25 years. And we'll be answering this question, security in a world of uncertainty. Before William speaks, I think it would be good just to get to know him. So perhaps I could ask William to come and join me up front. And I'm just going to ask him a couple of questions before I hand over. Thank you again, William, for being willing to speak for us. It's really kind of you.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're a Christian, hence why you're doing the talk for us. Just tell us why you decided to put your trust in Jesus. How did you sort of get going as a Christian?
Well, I think I grew up in a home that was formally Christian. I think I'd never quite twigged, and you'll think I'm remarkably stupid, but I'd never quite twigged that Christianity is about Jesus. I thought it was about being religious and keeping rules, going to church and that sort of thing. And I was asked to spend a bit of time away from the boarding school I attended at the time, for reasons which we won't go into this evening. And I went to stay with my grandfather, and over the weekend he explained that Christianity is essentially about Jesus Christ, and that Jesus is God. And it began to dawn on me that I'd been holding him, you know, very much at arm's length in my life. And over that weekend, I began to realize that I needed forgiveness for doing that in God's world. Not to recognize God is great offense to him. And my grandfather explained that Jesus died on the cross so that I could be forgiven. And it was that weekend, really, that I asked Jesus to be my Lord and to forgive me for having treated God so appallingly in his world.
Mm. So you were a teenager when that happened?
I was 18 and a half, I think.
Okay, so a few years ago.
Yes.
He turned on. There we go. Great. Can you now hear William? Yeah, good. Well, we'll find out in a minute.
I haven't spoken yet.
We'll find out in a minute. So since that point, what sort of kept you going as a Christian? How have you continued to trust in Jesus?
I think any true Christian would say that it is really Jesus himself who takes hold of you. I think it's a mistake to kind of say of oneself, well, I've kept going. So I think any true Christian will always say, the reason I have been sustained as a Christian is that God himself has taken hold of me and kept me. And I think I'd want to say that from my perspective, looking, the more I come to know of Jesus, the more I study who Jesus is, the more profoundly convincing and compelling he is. Historically, morally, his teaching, his love. You know, there is nobody who loves you more than Jesus Christ. He died for you. You know, just so from any angle I look at the teaching and claims of Jesus, you find it kind of stacks up. Mm. And the more you look at it, the more you find it stacks up. There's a great book at the back there, I hope, called Can We Trust the Gospels? And I've just been reading that. I'm going to read it a second time. I gave it to a QC friend of mine who I don't think would necessarily call himself a Christian. And he's read it. He said he's going to read it a second time on his summer holidays because it's so convincing. I'm excited to talk to him about that. Can we trust the Gospels? Do you know what he said? He said the arguments are so simple. And in our world, the QC's world, in our world, simplicity is the key. So can we trust the Gospels? That's something I've got really excited about, and I've been a Christian now for nearly 30 years.
That's great. Well, do follow up on some of that if you want to.
And then nearly 40 years, nearly 40 years.
40 years.
I was putting myself in at 48 there for a moment. You wouldn't have fallen for it, would you?
Now, speaking of numbers, so you've been in the city for 25 years, which is a good amount of time now. Tell us, how has the city changed over that period of time?
Well, that's a very good question. I think one of the big things that is very different is the whole world of compliance. So one of my mates from school went on to lead,
which bank was it? Merrill Lynch, I think. It was one of those banks, anyway. And I had tea with him, you know, a while ago. And I said, what do you spend your time doing? This is a couple of years back. And he said, I spend 50% of my time. He was CEO of this bank, I think it was Bank of America. And he said, I spend 50% of my time on compliance. And I said to him, well, that proves what crooks you all are. If you have to spend 50% of your time on compliance. You know, actually, if we were honest in the city, you wouldn't need compliance. But now the world and the city has become significantly less Christian. All sorts of things have been swept away, and that's true of the whole of society. As you drift from the teaching of Jesus, everything goes in family life, society. Anyway, we could go on for a long time, but that's a big one, compliance. I think just at the moment, the city is a much more fearful place than it was, but that goes ebbs and flows, that ebbs and flows. My observation is there's a lot more interest to take the teaching of Jesus seriously and to think about it, certainly in our part of the city, but I'm in insurance land, so, you know, it's very different up there. Under the gherkin, you know, but you think, well, they need Jesus, you'd probably say. But there seems to be a lot more openness. There seems to be a lot more openness. I'm going to try and persuade you that you need Jesus, actually. But there's a lot more openness in our part of the city at the moment. People are coming along to talks like this, kind of almost uninvited. They're just turning up because they want to find out more. I think there is a bit of a vacuum. In that sense, you know, secularism, we've had a go at that. And, you know, you look around the world and you think, well, and here is something of real substance you get your teeth into that stacks up, that is simple and yet incredibly profound. Mm. Anyway, I could go on.
Well, thank you. I'm going to hand over to you. I'll jump up again when you're finished and we'll take some questions.
Thanks. Well, look, thank you so much for coming this evening. Thank you. I know you didn't have much to do with it in terms of the invitation, but it's lovely to be here. And I want to talk about uncertainty and fear and where we can find security in a world of fear and uncertainty. A number of years ago, I was put to sit next to a city financier at lunch, and his name was Jonathan Ruffer. You may have come across him. He runs Ruffer PLC. And he explained to me the motives that drive the city in just two kind of terms, fear and greed. Now, you will have heard that, I'm sure. And I made the great mistake of asking Jonathan which he thought guided me. And without a second's hesitation, greed, he said, just like that, which I found rather offensive, but there we are. But there's no doubting today that fear and uncertainty is dominant. So whether it's the global crisis of 2007-08, or Brexit, Trump, Putin, Huawei, Hong Kong, newly enriched uranium being found in Iran, I read just on the BBC News just a couple of minutes ago, or whether it's Grenfell, or whether it's ISIL, or whether it's the prospect of Boris or Corbyn, fear and uncertainty. Fear and uncertainty take an awful lot of different forms, don't they? So there's the kind of personal fear, the kind when you visit the consultant or your partner's tongue, perhaps, or temper, discovery, perhaps. Some people are just frightened of being found out. Summons to the HR department. And then there's kind of corporate fear. And every now and then, you know, there's kind of Ebola thing. I remember travelling on the tube. Do you remember when they had the swine flu, bird flu, that was travelling around? And I normally cycle. I never travel on the tube. I usually get lost. But I had to take an unusual trip on the underground, and somebody sneezed. And you could almost feel the fear around the carriage. A friend of mine, until he became a Christian, used to run through Liverpool Street Station because he was frightened of death. Now, he became a Christian. He's not frightened of death anymore. He walks through quite casually. But that's a fear, isn't it? Corporate fear. And then there is the sudden fear that produces the rush of adrenaline. And then there's the nagging and gnawing fear and uncertainty. A number of occasions I've actually been in fear of my life over the last 58 years. The day I first wrote off my first car, I think we did a triple somersault on the M3. there was nobody else in it, thankfully. The day I was chased by a bull, another time I was chased by a bull elephant. The day I lost control of a tractor on a 1-in-4 hill. And I once worked for a boss who drank half a bottle of whiskey every evening. And life was not always fear-free working for Whiskey Jim, as we called him. And yet fear, uncertainty fear, it's not altogether a bad thing. So I live in a square down in the borough, and there's kind of a balustrade, you know, like in some of these squares, three, four floors up, and you can walk around it, so workmen can walk around. I came out of the house one day, and we live in the centre of the square, and I looked up, and there was a friend of mine's four-year-old child walking around the balustrade. He got out of the top window. You know, and fear can be a good thing. There are over 500 references to fear in the Bible. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. What I want to do is to look at just one brief incident in the life of Jesus. So I want us to consider it under two headings: the power of Jesus Christ and his offer of security, and then the challenge of Jesus Christ and the place of security. So the first heading is this: the power of Jesus Christ and his offer of security. If you take up the Matthew's Gospel, you'll see it there. There's nothing better than going back to the source documents when you come to consider the Christian faith. You know, go back to the original eyewitness material. If you turn to page 20, and I want us to see that if we follow Jesus, we can have ultimate security. I want us to see that Jesus scatters fear. Jesus scatters fear. Because Jesus has absolute authority, because he is the supreme power in the universe, both in this life and in the next life, he's the only one that counts. His is the only opinion that matters. He is Lord. Because Jesus has absolute authority, we need no fear if we're with him. He controls the past, he orders the present, he determines the future. With Jesus, you are secure. Now, in a sense, the whole of this book that you've got in your hand makes that point. The point of this book is to show us that Jesus is God's King. He has been crowned Lord and King of eternity, and his resurrection from the dead proves that. Nobody else has ever defeated death. In fact, the book finishes with the risen Jesus announcing, listen to this, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. I mean, Donald Trump sometimes says things like that, but we know what we think about that. But Jesus Christ, risen from the grave, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Now, the one incident that I want us to look at comes at the bottom of page 20. And if you like, it's just a kind of, you know, we're breaking in, we're taking a sample. We've got a number of scientists with us. You're used to doing this sort of thing from down at Guy's. So we're breaking, we're just taking a sample, and it's there at the bottom, and it's entitled, Jesus Calms a Storm. When he got into the boat, his disciples followed him, and behold, there arose a great storm on the sea, so that the boat was being swamped by the waves, but he was asleep. And when they went and woke him, saying, Save us, Lord, we are perishing. And he said to them, Why are you afraid, O you of little faith? He arose, he rebuked the wind and the sea, there was a great calm. The men marveled, saying, What sort of man is this, that even winds and sea obey him? Now, I've got no doubt that this incident actually happened. It's recorded independently by Matthew, by Mark, and by Luke. Mark, in fact, tells us that there were other boats on the lake at the same time, not just this one. And can I say, it reads like an eyewitness account? So verse 24, behold, there arose a great storm on the sea, so the boat was being swamped by the waves, but he was asleep. They went and woke him, saying, Save us, Lord, we're perishing. Now, I'm neither a sailor nor a meteorologist. In fact, I fear the sea. But I'm told that the Galilean lake is like a sea, of such size that fierce and violent storms come up very frequently and suddenly, and they are sufficiently powerful to sink a boat of experienced fishermen. And Jesus' disciples were certainly that. This storm was beyond them. They reached the limit of their abilities. In their terror, realizing they're about to be destroyed, they scramble to the back of the boat and they wake Jesus. Now, there are a number of things to note. First, that Jesus was asleep. I mean, if you were making this up, if this were some sort of myth and you were making it up, would you ever have Jesus asleep at the back of the boat in a storm like this? I think you wouldn't. Secondly, that Jesus simply speaks. So you can see it at the end of verse 26. He rose, he rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. This speaks of absolute authority. Jesus is one who stepped in from outside of his creation and now in creation is Lord and Master of creation. As the elements rise up in uncontrolled chaos, Jesus has total control, supreme command. He speaks. It's as if Jesus was standing in Florida as one of the autumn hurricanes broke, whether it's Florence or Michael or Harvey or Irma or Maria or whatever, or as if Jesus were in Papua New Guinea or on the streets of Christchurch, New Zealand, or the Nepalese foothills as the first tremors were felt. And notice the immediacy of the calm. He rose, rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. Glassy flat, not a ripple, peace. I come from the West Country and we go bodyboarding. I bet some of you have been bodyboarding down in the West Country. And one time my wife and I went all the way down to Penzance. Never, rarely go down there. They're very sort of wild down there. I come from further up the county. But anyway, we ventured down to the Senna Cove and we were bodyboarding there. But the waves, they were incredibly powerful. And I said to one of the locals, how come the waves are so strong today? Oh, there's been a storm in Florida. And the waves had gathered somehow. And yet Jesus speaks, and it's calm. Now, either this was made up, or here is the divine being, the creator of the universe, who stepped into his order, his created order, with supreme power and authority over all things. And like a trainer with a puppy, or an adult with an obedient child, find me one of those, he just speaks. And glassy flat. My favourite beach in the West Country is a place called Atlantic Bay. It used to be totally secluded until the Daily Telegraph did a piece on it, and now it's swarming with people. But anyway, don't worry about that. I love to go down there. It's kind of on my own, and I'll sometimes stand behind a rock when the waves are really crashing. And if I know I'm going to be speaking on a passage like this, I'll just give it a go. Be still. Do you know what happens? Absolutely nothing. Or if somebody hears me, they come and pat me on the forehead. But I think the most surprising thing is to be found at the beginning of verse 26. So, verse 25, they went and woke him, saying, "Save us, Lord, we're perishing." And he said to them, "Why are you afraid, O you of little faith?" In other words, to Jesus, to know him, to have him with you, is to need no fear. Now, let's be clear. He's not suggesting that with Jesus, you and I will never suffer fallout from the credit card crunch, or that we'll never be caught up in an earthquake or a storm at sea. That's exactly what's happening. They are in a storm at sea. So he's not saying that with Jesus, you're going to kind of be in la-la land, a kind of Disneyfied Bambi world where everything is fine forever. In fact, two Christian couples I know well have been in full-on, top-scale earthquakes. I talked to Jay and Jamie. They were in Christchurch for both of the earthquakes. And Jay talks about wading through liquefied rock through the centre of Christchurch up to his thighs, trying to find his three children in three separate schools following the earthquake. So following Jesus is not to be lifted out into this kind of weird world where nothing bad ever happens. but rather with Jesus, if only we will recognize who he is, then we really need fear no greater power. He controls the past, he orders the present, he determines the future. Why are you afraid, O you of little faith? There is a God, his name is Jesus, he controls the past, he orders the present, he determines the future. He's broken into his world to show us that he exists. And if you will put your trust in him, you can have absolute security in a world of uncertainty. Now, at this point, we've just sort of broken in and taken a little sample out of the middle of Matthew's gospel. I could take you to incident after incident after incident after incident. But the point of this gospel, and I'd love to persuade you to take it away and read it for yourself, the point of this gospel is for Matthew, the eyewitness follower of Jesus, has lined up for us, if you like, the evidence to show us that Jesus really is who he says he is. It begins with evidence that he is God's king. It concludes with Jesus having been raised from the dead and saying to his disciples, "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Go and make disciples of all nations." And we find that at the end of his life, Jesus, in his love for you and me, goes to his death on a cross to carry God's judgment at you and I having failed to live as we should in God's world, so that we can be forgiven. And now the King of Kings says to us, well, if only you'll follow me, you can have security, absolute security. Your failure forgiven. The debts, if you like, wiped clean, paid once and for all. Security in a world of uncertainty. And, I mean, this is a slightly kind of quiche way of putting it, you know, but with Jesus in the boat, there's no need of fear. If you'll do what I did on December the 18th, 1979, and ask Jesus to come in as Lord of your life, then at the helm is the one who made the universe. It's pretty special, isn't it? I've been doing my job as a clergyman since 1991. I think that's 29 years, or is it 28 years? Anyway, can't do my maths this evening. I've been with men and women in every circumstance of life, sickness, personal family trauma, job loss, three major recessions, and I've sat with men and women as quite literally they have walked through the valley of the shadow of death. Now, there's a wonderful verse in what is the most famous song in the Bible, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me." And may I suggest that without this reality, you're alone. Without this reality, you are alone. If you come across Jacques Monod, he's a French guy, a philosopher, scientific philosopher. I think Richard Dawkins got most of his ideas from Jacques Monod. He was writing in the 1960s. His name, I think, is pronounced as Jacques Monod. I once heard him introduced as Jake Monod in Australia. That was fun, wasn't it? I really enjoyed that. But listen to this. This is Richard Dawkins got most of his ideas, as far as I can make out, from this guy. "Man knows at last that he is alone in the universe's unfeeling immensity, out of which he emerged only by chance. His destiny is nowhere spelled out, nor his duty. The kingdom above or the darkness below, it's for him to choose." See, without this certainty of a living God, you're on your own, mate. And it's right to be fearful. Now, we can't leave this incident having only looked at the power of Jesus. I want us to look very briefly at the challenge of Jesus and the place of security. So the power and his offer, and now the challenge and the place. For what Matthew has done in this incident, and Matthew is a beautiful writer. He is so carefully crafted. What he's done in this incident is put together a number of incidents that show Jesus' authority and then punctuate it with implication. And if you have a look to page 20 and verse 22, so it's just up the column there above where Jesus calms the storm, we'll take it from verse 21, shall we? Another of the disciples said to him, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." And Jesus said to him, "Follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead." Turn the page to page 22. And where Jesus calls Matthew, that's the author of this gospel, in verse 9 there. Jesus passed on from there. He saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth. He said to him, "Follow me." And he rose and followed him. Now, here is the very simple point. There is on offer this evening ultimate security in a world of fear. There can be no doubt that these things cause abject terror, deep fear, real anxiety, deep uncertainty. And there is one who has authority over all these things: death, disease, disorder, climate change, and so forth. But ultimate security can only come as we stop holding God at arm's length and turn to Jesus as our Lord. And therefore, ultimate security comes with a challenge. You can't be really secure in the arms of the one who has absolute power unless you embrace the one who has absolute power. Otherwise, you're on the other side. There can be no freedom without following. Any power to deliver must come with a demand for discipleship, because if he is absolutely in control of everything, if he's Lord and King, then he's your Lord and King. And until you surrender, you can't have the security that's on offer, because you're on the wrong side. The logic is inescapable. And I'm going to give you a rather trite illustration, if you won't mind. There was a guy who worked on our staff up at St. Helens a number of years ago, and he had a son, and I'll call him Charlie, the boy. And Charlie, the boy, used to kind of, every time he met me, I don't know what I'd done to kind of deserve this, but every time, he must have been about five, and he used to stand there and go, "Rah!" like this at me, as if he was a lion. And, you know, I would kind of make a noise back at him, as you do with small children, but one day I thought I'd give him the full works. And so he came up to me and went, "Rah!" And I kind of, you know, sort of, and I'm not going to give you a demo tonight because I won't be able to complete the talk, but anyway, he was absolutely scared, witless, poor child. And he fled for his dad, grabbed him round the thigh, and just clutched him like that. Now, the illustration doesn't quite work, because I reckon I could take his dad even now, but so we won't go into it. But what he did was, here is security, I'm going to clutch to it. Now, you see, you can't have ultimate security from Jesus unless you're prepared to change sides. The logic's obvious, isn't it? So long as I hold Jesus at arm's length, then I'm in the boat on my own. The day I embrace Jesus... then I am in the hands of one who loves me more than I can imagine, who orders the universe, who controls this life and the next. Now, does that not make sense of Jesus' rebuke in our incident on page 20, top of page 21? "Why are you so afraid? Don't you realize who I am? Can't you see my authority? Have you not grasped yet that there is a God and that I am that God? Why are you holding me at arm's length?" And so we are safe with him. And I could spend all evening talking about this. I'm not going to. But again and again and again, Matthew is wanting to show us his authority. A number of things that cause us fear. you know, career progress. I remember sitting next to some young lad in Fleet Street asking him, after giving a talk like this, what are you frightened of? And he said, I'm frightened of not fulfilling my potential. I thought, you poor, sad thing, to walk through life fearful of not fulfilling your potential. If you come to Jesus, well, you will fulfill your potential in this life and the next. Facebook fear, you know, I'm fearful for my status. What might they post about me, or what might get out into the open? Come to Jesus so you can have real security. And then ultimate fear, death and God's judgment, meeting him face to face, knowing that we've held him at arm's length and not lived in his world as we should. Come to Jesus. Forgiveness. The slate wiped clean. Welcome. Well, I think I've spoken for long enough. There's a little testimony of Jeremy Marshall at the back I was going to read. I'm not going to read that now, but I'm going to commend this book to you, City Lives, where you'll find all sorts of other city workers who have come to Jesus, and it's full of their testimonies of what difference Jesus has made to them. Tom.
William, thank you very much indeed. We've got a chance now to take some questions. Chris is going to come around collecting any questions that you may have written down. So if you do, just sort of wave them at Chris and he will pick those up and give them to me. And I will pose them to William. Whilst we're doing that, perhaps I could begin with a question, if I may. So you turned to Jesus, put your trust in Jesus as a teenager. You've spoken tonight of security, forgiveness. Tell us a little bit more about what difference that has made for you over the years now.
Well, I think knowing that God is in charge of everything changes everything. Knowing that you're forgiven. I mean, some of you young ones, sorry, that sounds horribly patronising, but I tell you, an extraordinary thing happened to me about 5 years ago. I suddenly start remembering things that I've done or said. Now, maybe that happens to you when you were 22 and I'm just remarkably thick. But, you know, you can't walk through life without some having done and said some really extraordinary things, unless you're very odd. And these things will come back and haunt you. And to know that you're forgiven by the only one who really counts is the most beautiful thing. So that I can meet God face to face knowing that he loves me and has forgiven me. That is the big one, I think. Mm.
Got another question here, sort of related to what we've been saying, but a chance to expand. You said this whole book is about showing us that Jesus is King. Just a bit more about what that has to do with us. What does that mean?
Well, exactly that. Jesus comes to Matthew and says, follow me. So if Jesus is God, living in his world as an independent agent is an offensive thing to him. See, if God made everything, then to live in his world without acknowledging him, it would be like the most kind of recalcitrant teenager, totally ignoring their parents and just living in the world with no reference whatsoever to mum and dad, and pillaging the house and being obnoxious to the siblings, and simply not paying any attention to the parents at all. So to live in God's world with no reference to him, it would be like working for a company and being paid by the company, but quietly actually working undercover for another company next door. Receiving all the benefits, but actually being a rebel or a dishonest. You see, so if Jesus is God, it has profound implications. It means he comes to us not with a, would you mind terribly following me? You know, I've got all these goodies to offer you. But I am your Lord, whether you like it or not, whether you believe it or not. You will be answerable to me at the end. Turn around and follow. So it's a very different appeal. And so, follow me, is what he says.
Well, I guess a lot of this hangs on what we're reading tonight. Yes. In Matthew's Gospel and in the Bible. And there's a question here, how can I know that the Bible is true?
Well, I would encourage you very strongly to ask the person you've come with for a copy of Can We Trust the Gospels? I mean, The book overturns a lot of the kind of more sceptical scholarship that has been knocking around for a number of years. Historically, I would say, read the Gospels. Funnily enough, when I read the Gospels with lawyers, and I do regularly, they frequently say to me, this reads like eyewitness testimony. And the two things that they particularly appeal to is, one, the stories don't all stack up in precise detail. They're just minor differences. They don't countermand one another, but they're just minor differences. And when I go to court, they say to me, I'm not a lawyer, when I go to court, they say to me, if the stories are all totally stitched up, then you begin to smell a rat. But you read these four accounts, and there are just minor differences, and it makes you say, hang on, it just reads. And the second thing they say to me is the key players always seem to come out badly. And when you hear a stitched-up testimony, the key player pretty much always comes out smelling of roses. But the key players in the Gospels... Now, that's kind of old hat stuff, which you take a Gospel and read it. But there are so many things in the Gospels that just cross-corroborate one another. Here's a funny little one, and it's only one little piece from tonight's incident. Matthew calls Lake Galilee a sea. So does John, and so does Mark, I think. Luke calls it a lake. Now, if you'd not travelled, the Sea of Galilee is over 20 miles long, but it's only a lake. If you've not travelled, you call it a sea, as do the people of Nazareth of the time. But if you travelled, like Luke, who sailed with the Apostle Paul all around the Mediterranean, you knew that it was only a lake. Luke calls it a lake. Now, that's a tiny, tiny little detail, but it's one of those kind of things which, if you were just making it up, you wouldn't... I mean, you can read it for yourself, but there are just lots and lots of little things like that. For the feeding of the 5,000, another miracle, for example. With the feeding of the 5,000, it happens in a desert place, and... In one gospel, we're told the grass is green, but we're not told when it happens. In another gospel, we're told it happens at Passover. Passover was spring. The only time it rains in the desert was spring. And so, do you see, here we've got two different accounts kind of cross-corroborating in that sort of way. Anyway, there are so many things like that which make me think this is eyewitness material. And you might say, oh, it couldn't have happened, because there is no God, and therefore supernatural things can't happen. And I want to say that I don't think that's very scientific. To rule out the conclusion before you looked at the evidence, to say, oh, supernatural things can't happen because there is no God, and therefore supernatural, it's a profound piece of circular logic that is almost mystical. Certainly not scientific.
That's very helpful. We've got time for a few more questions. Do, as William said, if you want to take a Matthew's Gospel away, ask a friend that brought you to perhaps look at that with you. They will buy the coffee, I'm sure, and I think that would be a great thing to look at that further. We've got a question here. You spoke of the fact that Jesus controls even the past. When I turn to Jesus, trust in him, he controls the past. Just a clarification of what you mean by that.
He orders the present, he controls, and he determines the future. I think when you read Matthew's Gospel, you'll notice that again and again and again, Matthew appeals to what happened in a 2,000-year period before the coming of Jesus. So Jesus doesn't just kind of drop into his created order out of the blue. There is an expectation of his arrival. Had he dropped into the created order out of the blue, you would not be able to make head or tail of him, and nor would I, because he's God. And so for 2,000 years before the coming of Jesus Christ, God, if you like, set up the categories by which we could make sense of his coming when he came. And to that extent, I'd say Jesus kind of orders the whole of the past to ensure that when he comes into this world, we have the necessary framework and categories to be able to understand who he is and what he's come for. Again, you'll see that if you take a look at Matthew's Gospel. It means, therefore, that we can have confidence when we read the Gospels that we are understanding them rightly. Because if there is what I call a matrix or a framework of interpretation into which Jesus steps, then you've got, if you like, cross connections which enable you to be sure that the way you are reading it is actually what it's intended to mean. So sometimes people say to me, oh, well, it's just your interpretation. I say, well, hang on a second. No, because Jesus steps into a matrix of interpretive understanding, you cannot read the calming of the storm any other way than this.
So the Old Testament actually gives us our interpretive tools and keys for the New Testament.
It does. And many, many Christians, I think, fail to make use of that in their kind of persuasive attempts to help others to trust the Gospels. How much time have we got?
Let's have a look.
I was at dinner the other day. A friend of mine asked me to dinner, and he said, I'm going to ask all my neighbours to dinner as well, and I want you to talk about the Christian message. And look to kind of talk, and I've told them to give you a run for your money. Well, they obliged their host, I can tell you. There were two M&A lawyers. There was somebody with a PhD in medieval history, and there was a barrister from just down the road here. And they went at it hammer and tongs. And I was dealing with the evidence for the resurrection, and they just said, oh, it's just your interpretation, it's just your interpretation. And it was only towards the end of the evening, and they were going at it like this. I thought, well, it isn't just my interpretation. Because Psalm 16 makes it very clear that when God's king steps into the world, he will never see death. When Jesus rises from the grave, what does it tell us about him? He's the only one who's ever done it. And then there are other instances of the Old Testament anticipating a Messiah who will reign forever and have an eternal kingdom. So there's an interpretive matrix, you see. Anyway, there we go.
That's really helpful. Time, I think, just for one more question. You mentioned changing sides, turning to Jesus, phrases like that a few times. What does that actually mean, practically, if someone is at the stage of wanting to do that?
Yes, well, there may well be somebody like that. Maybe you're saying to yourself, look, I want to think more about this. The kind of Christianity Explored course, reading a Matthew's Gospel with a friend or a colleague, is a great way. A lot of people doing that on my part of the city. Chris gives me such a hard time. I know you're
on the edge of the city.
On the edge of the city, where we come from. A lot of people doing that kind of guided read through. But it may be that this evening you say, look, actually, yes, I've heard the Lord Jesus' voice. Follow me. And really, it is just a prayer. A simple prayer that changes everything. So my granddad gave me an ABC prayer to pray. He obviously thought I couldn't go much beyond that. Admit that you've been living in God's world without God as your king. I'm so sorry. Believe that Jesus died on the cross for you. Thank you so much that you love me enough to die for me and forgive my sins. Commit your life to him. A, admit. B, believe. C, commit your life to him. Oh, it'll be a great thing. It's a simple prayer. It changes everything. I went upstairs that evening. I knelt by my bed, and I prayed that prayer as I knelt by my bed. I came down the next morning. I said to my granddad, well, what should I do next? And he gave me the best piece of advice any grandfather could ever give. He said, read your Bible every day, do what it says, and leave the consequences to God. It's very simple, isn't it? In one sense.
Thank you so much, William.